everyone. I'm Gary Nolan, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special two-hour broadcast on HIV and AIDS and the science and censorship involved in this entire movement. In our first hour, we will be co-hosting with David Crow.
Hi.
Nice to have you with us today, David.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be with you today, Gary. I think this is going to be a great show.
We also will be joined from the United Kingdom, London, Joan Shenton. Joan is a longtime medical documentary filmmaker who started covering controversies over HIV and AIDS in the late 1980s. Despite winning awards for her films, she was eventually censored and for years could not work in the field. More recently, she produced the historical documentary Positively False, and most relevant to today's discussion, Positive Hell, the story of former heroin addicts in northern Spain who had been living with an HIV diagnosis for almost 30 years, almost entirely without drugs, and with the exception of one person in the documentary, in good health. Joan is also the author of Positively False. She heads the Immunity Resource Foundation in the United Kingdom, which has a fantastic collection of archival AIDS documentary footage. Her website is Joan Shenton, shenton.com. She will be joined from Kentucky with Bobby Russell. Bobby was diagnosed with HIV positive condition in late 2004. In 2013, he learned that a negative HIV diagnosis on a Western blot HIV test had been withheld from him. Consequently, went off the AIDS drugs and sued for restitution due to the damage from the drugs he had taken for 8 years. The case was recently thrown out on a technicality, and he is appealing. His story and information can be found on his website, bobbywrussell.com. And also, we will have an interview with others.
Ann Sono, a German filmmaker, and Peter, who is a man who has been HIV positive without AIDS drugs since 1986.
Good. In our second hour, we will be joined by Professor Peter Duisberg from Berkeley. Professor Duisberg is a molecular and cellular biology professor, University of California, Berkeley. He was the first to isolate a cancer gene through his work with retroviruses back in the 1970s and map the genetic structure of this class of viruses. His work in retrovirus research awarded him an election to the National Academy of Sciences, as well as outstanding investigator grants from the National Institutes of Health. Now, based upon his knowledge of retroviruses, he has been at the forefront in challenging the virus AIDS hypothesis and is published in the world's leading medical journals. As a consequence, Dr. Duisberg's hypothesis has won support from many scientists who have been outcast from publishing their views, including Nobel laureates such as Kary Mullis, the inventor of the PCR technology used in AIDS. And if time permits, we'll hear from Professor Mullis, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist, later on in the program. Also, Professor Henry Bauer. Professor Bauer is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies and a former dean at Virginia Polytech Institute, and was the dean of the university's College of Arts and Sciences for a stint. After his retirement, he served as the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration for 7 years. Professor Bauer did his doctorate at the University of Sydney in Australia and postdoctoral work at the University of Michigan. Now, he is the author of several books, including Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, How Dominant Theories Monopolize Research and Stifle the Search for Truth, and earlier, The Origin, Persistence and Failings in the HIV-AIDS Theory, which was among the first books to gather together 2 decades of research on HIV and AIDS and to identify the scientific contradictions. Also in the second hour will be Terry Michael from Washington, D.C. Terry is a seasoned political reporter and press secretary who is currently the executive director for the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism, which sponsors the Politics and Journalism semester to educate future political reporters. Now, in the mid-1980s, he was the press secretary for the Democratic National Committee and later the press aide for Congressman Paul Simon and as well as Robert Matusi. Terry has several journalism awards, including the Distinguished Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists and the Presidential Award for the Association of Education and Journalism. Although being a journalist and a gay man living in Washington, D.C., the most critical city on the HIV/AIDS agenda, he became active in the controversial eight years ago, and this coming Sunday, after coming in contact with Christina Maggiore's website, particularly on issues of censorship in the mainstream media. His website is terrymichael.net. Those are some of the people you can expect to hear from. Now, David, let's begin with you. First, let people know about yourself and the fact that it is no longer just a handful of individuals, scientists, physicians, journalists, activists, gay activists, who are interested in trying to see if what we were originally told about what caused AIDS, the HIV virus, and how to diagnose that and how to treat it were legitimate and honest science. And then how many people we have questioning this today, give some of their backgrounds, and why the mainstream media and organizations such as ACT UP refuse to have open, honest dialogues on these topics.
Well, I'm the host. Some people may have listened to my show on PRN, The Infectious Myth. I'm also the president of Rethinking AIDS, so I've been studying this issue since the mid-1990s. Some of the things I've learned along the way are that, first of all, there's a huge amount of science that reveals questions about the HIV/AIDS dogma, that the mainstream media doesn't want to know about it. The scientific journals also don't want to know about it. But there are a large number of brave people who've weathered the storms and who have publicly stated that they question the HIV/AIDS theory. And I'm maintaining a list which is getting pretty close to 3,000 names of people with MDs, PhDs, other accomplishments or educational statuses or things like that. So there are a lot of people who are questioning the dogma, and I think it's becoming a little bit easier to talk about it, but the money talks louder than anything else. And I think in the second hour we'll hear about a paper that was recently published, and it was only kept published when an alternative, an establishment attack on it was also published. And the man who published that attack has received since 1994 about $38 million in funding just from the National Institutes of Health alone. So the money in HIV and AIDS has totally corrupted the science. People who question the dogma, like Peter Duisberg, get virtually no money or no money at all. And those who write, unscientific garbage and recycle it time after time get continuous funding because they're helping to support the dogma, which helps the maintain the drug companies' sales of AIDS drug.
All right, let's begin with Joan Shenton. Nice to have you with us today, Joan.
Hello, Gary. It's lovely to hear you.
Joan, let's begin by having you share the story for people who have not heard you before and are not aware of the controversy. My core audience certainly is, but the vast majority of people tuning in right now all over the world don't even know there is a controversy surrounding AIDS. And when they hear the word AIDS denialist or AIDS denier and have that moniker at people who have outstanding reputations, who've never denied AIDS-defining illnesses nor an ability to help them, but rather challenge the politics around it and bad science, you were one of the first journalists, international journalists, along with Neville Hodgkinson, who, from the Times of London, who began to look more carefully and more critically. Tell us about your journey, what you discovered, and the consequences of that journey.
Well, Gary, it all began in 1987 when I had a small production company specializing in medical issues and was making documentaries about injury from prescribed drugs. But one of our researchers, Jad Adams, went to America and he read Peter Duisberg's article in Cancer Research, in which Peter challenged HIV as the cause of AIDS and said that HIV was a dormant passenger retrovirus that couldn't possibly cause AIDS. And so we made our first film called AIDS, The Unheard Voices, which included Peter. And to our surprise and delight, the film actually won the highest award here, the Royal Television Society Award for Journalism. And we thought we were going to change the world. We thought that the whole AIDS edifice of HIV causing death and of AIDS being infectious would all tumble down. But the film went out into a pool of silence, and nothing changed to our astonishment. Anyway, we persevered, and we made several other documentaries, one called The AIDS Catch, another called AZT Cause for Concern, and another called AIDS and Africa. They were all network broadcast documentaries. And still nothing has changed. And I don't know how long you want me to speak, Gary, but culminating in the fact that we managed to make a documentary recently in Spain, which was launched last week. And there, I was surprised by the fact that there was very little hostility. It's called Positive Hell. And people really were quite receptive to the idea. And also, I'm really pleased to say that there's been an article in a magazine called Vice, which just went up today, where the whole of the exposition about HIV not being the cause of AIDS is laid before everybody. And, I mean, this kind of thing hasn't happened for 20 years, really, that someone's written an article saying HIV isn't the cause of AIDS and published it in a popular magazine. I mean, Celia Farber used to write wonderful columns for Spin magazine in the old days in America, but that was for Bob Guccione Jr.'s publication. But it hasn't happened for a very long time, Gary, so I'm feeling on the up.
Good. Why don't you take a few moments and, as a multi-award-winning journalist, show us what you uncovered about the AIDS paradigm that would give anyone listening concern.
Well, basically, there were just so many anomalies. I mean, for example, the test. You know, the test is a complete disaster area. There's no gold standard for it. You can be positive in one country and negative in another, and yet people are told they're going to die. That, to me, is an absolute tragedy. The poisoning of a whole generation of gay men in the late 80s and early 90s with AZT, which is what Peter Duisberg was so concerned about and led us to make the film AZT Cause for Concern. People were given 2,000 milligrams of AZT, which is a DNA chain terminator, and they all died. I don't know of a single survivor, but apparently there may be some here or there. And only last week at the launch of our film, Dr. Klaus Kernlein from Germany in Kiel, he actually said that we had killed these people with AZT. And so on. So we've got the test, we've got AZT, we've got the curse that everyone's going to die, the fact that it's sexually transmitted. We've never had a sexually transmitted epidemic of any kind. We've never had a heterosexual epidemic.
And in the new film, Positive Hell, you document people who for almost 30 years lived with an HIV diagnosis without taking drugs, or at least not for a very long time.
Of course. I mean, in that film, there was a group of young people in the north of Spain, lots of young people, who were able to buy heroin very cheaply. There was a wave of drugs came through the north of Spain, and a lot of them became addicted. And then when they went into clinics for their addiction, they were tested for HIV, and they were found to be positive. And then they managed to get off the heroin, and at that time there wasn't really the money for the expensive drugs like AZT, so their doctors just said, get on with your lives. And Raquel, for example, she had two daughters. Both of her daughters inherited the HIV antibodies, but after 18 months, as is the case and well known and documented in medicine, the babies lost their mother's antibodies, and the young women have grown up perfectly fit and healthy. One of them's a lawyer, another one's got another career. And at a screening of this film in Spain, where we were nominated for Best Documentary at the Marbella Film Festival, Raquel's daughter came down to the screening, and she wept after the film as she thanked her parents for not allowing her to become part of the AIDS zone.
What happened to you professionally and personally because you stood up, looked for the truth, documented it, published it, wrote about it, broadcast about it, had never had this problem before in your entire career, a distinguished career in journalism in England, and then the pushback came. Tell us about that, please.
Well, the pushback, as you describe it, started when the companies manufacturing AZT, it was Welcome, really, realized that we were going to produce a film that was going to damage their sales, probably, so they threatened an injunction on Channel 4. They wrote letters to the chairman and then tried to pressure Channel 4 not to show the film, and then the entire establishment, really, the journalistic establishment, came down on us like a ton of bricks, which included, of course, all the AIDS barons, as I call them. They were doing research for the Medical Research Council, and they were involved in multi-million research programs on HIV. They all came down on us like a ton of bricks, and we were kind of hounded out of town. I left and went to the Dominican Republic and wrote my book. But I certainly, you know, couldn't work in mainstream journalism here anymore.
Joan, please hold on. Let's go over now and say hello to Bobby Russell. Nice to have you with us today, Bobby.
Nice to be with you also, Gary and David and Joan. Hello.
Hi.
I'm
going to ask you to speak up. Now, Bobby, tell us your story.
I became misdiagnosed in December of 2004 for having HIV. It was in September 18th of 2004, and I began a series of medications eventually in December of 2004 I guess it was sometime around October the 15th of 2013, and that's whenever I discontinued the use of medications and have remained medication-free since then. So I'm hoping to survive on this. It's a long road for me, mentally and emotionally. So.
And why did you stop the medications in 2013?
Well, my lawsuit was actually filed in August of 2013, and I was still currently taking medications because I was in I really believed each of the physicians that I was under the care of for the 9 years that I did take treatment. And when the lawsuit was filed, I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what to do. I was just so lost. And I begged for them to allow me to continue on with treatment until I could see if I had came in touch or develop some type of viral infection as a result of the misdiagnosis, but the university insisted on the removal of the treatment within 30 days, and I couldn't find no one that would continue the prescription or the treatment, and I just sat down and
discovered
reality.
What you had discovered was that back in 2004 that they had done a Western blot test, that it was negative, but they had never told you that.
That is correct. It's really, now that I've been off medications for quite some time, I think back in it now, and I'm really disappointed in myself for believing in such individuals. especially the first physician that began the treatment, as recently she was the president of the American Medical Association here in the United States. And I really believed her, and she insisted that my test was positive. The Western blot test was positive, but it was actually negative. And no one had never looked at the test result.
How, David, from your research, how common is this where people have false positives or are negative and they're not told they're negative?
Well, this is a bit unusual because there's a lot of problems with false positive HIV tests, and some people would say that all HIV tests are false positives. But it is a little bit rare to withhold a test result completely. I mean, even the establishment standards on HIV testing don't say anything about withholding a negative result to let somebody continue to believe that they're positive. So I'm not exactly sure what that is, but each what most people don't realize is each AIDS patient is worth a lot of money, because AIDS drugs are so expensive that virtually no HIV positive people can pay for their own drugs. So there are all kinds of government and charitable programs to pay for drugs. And so for an institution, and I think he was at, Bobby, you were at the University of Kentucky, right? Or Kentucky,
yes,
University Medical Center?
Yes, that is
correct. They get a lot of money as part of this treatment, because they're getting paid to dispense the drugs, and they might be able to enroll him in a clinical trial. There's a lot of money revolving around each HIV-positive patient, so there is a motivation to keep people within the realm of HIV-positive, even if they're not.
Joan, Bobby, hold on. Joan, I would like for you to address the not just anomalies, but what you have found are easily deconstructed myths about AIDS on any level that the mainstream media, the medical media, had a responsibility to do the same research and could have found the same results you did, but chose not to.
Well, I think the sexual transmission is one. I don't think anybody's properly analyzed how on earth HIV could be transmitted sexually. I'm not an expert, and I would prefer a virologist or someone else to try and explain that. But I think that there should be far more research about that. Secondly, anyone in contact, many incidences of partners who don't become antibody positive, as I call it. Thirdly, as I said earlier, I can't see any sign of an epidemic. Let me think. Deconstruct.
What about the HIV tests you sent out one time for testing?
Yes. We got some funding from Channel 4, and we sent 26 blood samples of people with high protein levels, IgG and IgM, because they had TB or malaria or rheumatoid arthritis. Who were at risk of testing positive, because after all, the positive test is looking at antibody profiles. And we tested 26 blood samples on three separate commercial test kits. This was done at Surrey University. And we got the most extraordinary results on one of the test kits. 19 of the people who'd been tested, the samples, tested indeterminate, and some the highest level of indeterminate, which could almost be positive, whereas on the other kits they were negative. And one individual, Peter, he was negative on all three kits, right? And this was done with numbered blinded runs. He was positive on all three kits. Then I went with him personally to two major teaching hospitals in London, and he had a test, and he was negative in both. So those sorts of anomalies. And also, of course, Western blot, because you know that in England, Dr. Mortimer, who was head of our public health laboratories, he said Western blot is so unreliable that we shouldn't use it anymore. We should use a double ELISA test. So, but other countries decided to keep it on. I think America still uses Western blot to confirm, and Scotland does. So So we took a group of people and we took blood samples in England, had them tested, and then went to Scotland and had them tested with a Western blot. And we had three or four distinct anomalies. One major one where one was positive in Scotland, but not in England. In Scotland on the Western blot. So anyway, I mean, that's the kind of thing one has been living with. But the trouble is there's absolutely no money to do a proper study. These were small samples, really.
And so in England, Bobby Russell might be HIV positive. And yet in America and Scotland, because of the Western blot, he would be HIV negative and considered uninfected.
Yeah, but no, he might have a double ELISA here without a Western blot.
Right.
And not be positive. And he might go to Scotland and have a double ELISA and a Western blot and be positive.
This depends on the day and the ELISA test kit and a bunch of other days of the moon.
What you're both saying is something the audience has to understand. You have to have a gold standard, and it has to be absolute.
Yeah.
And there is no gold standard. It has never been a gold standard, and it is recognized there's no gold standard. In fact, there are over 70 different medical conditions, from pregnancy to arthritis to the flu to leprosy.
Very good point.
And any one of those or combinations of those can create a false positive. And in Africa in particular, the numbers were falsified there simply because they wouldn't give blood chemistry many of the times. They would simply give you, do you have fatigue? Do you have a non-productive dry cough? Have you lost a certain percentage of your body weight? Well, that's malaria. That's schistosomiasis. That's tuberculosis. That's gross malnutrition. That's a consequence of civil war. And yet, they would immediately say, you have AIDS, and put them on AZT. Then when they got sicker and died, they say, see, thank goodness we at least got the person on some drugs, because otherwise they would have died quicker. And we start to see this, and we also saw this from a physician, a French physician, who found that when he gave good people clean water, good food, they were healthy again. Well, if you had this AIDS virus that's supposed to kill no matter what you do, then all those people should have died. And all those children in the orphanage she was working with that were considered AIDS orphans, they should have died, but they didn't. So there is the scientific community refusing to acknowledge they have no gold standard, that if you were sexually active and you were sexually promiscuous and you were using amyl nitrate, and you were malnourished or you were smoking and drinking, you have multiple immune deficiencies, easy to test positive for the HIV virus. Doesn't mean you have it. It means you test positive for an antibody. And in all other science, an antibody is protective. The reason you get vaccinated is to give you that particular antibody. Would you address these issues, both of you, on this?
Well, you've reminded me of something that happened right at the beginning of all of this, and that was that there was a group of men in Orange County, California, who were, in fact, using drugs for assisted sex. And so they were leading a very high-risk lifestyle at the time, and they became ill. And they were taking amyl nitrite, mainly, and that's poppers. And they developed Kaposi sarcoma, which are lesions on the skin, and a kind of pneumonia called PCP, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. And at that time, their condition was called a toxic condition. They said it was caused by the amyl nitrites, and they called it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. But then when the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the Centers for Disease Control heard about this cluster, they came to investigate. And it's a long story and it's technical, which I can't really explain now. But they decided it wasn't a toxic cluster, but it was an infectious cluster. And that's when the whole thing went wrong.
Yes, and to talk about the testing technology a little bit, I mean, the ELISA test is supposed to be a test that includes the proteins of HIV and then blood or urine or other samples are added to it And if those samples contain antibodies against HIV, there should be a reaction which causes a color change, which causes the sample to be considered reactive. The problem is, where did the HIV proteins come from? They should come from purified HIV, but one of the problems with HIV is that it has never been purified. So they just take the proteins out of cell cultures. And what are they getting out of the cell culture? Well, they added supposedly HIV-infected blood to a cell culture, and then they found certain proteins which they believed to be from HIV, but they never proved it. So the whole ELISA test is based on a very shaky foundation. And then the Western blot test, which is used in many places, not England, but it's used extensively in the U.S., it's actually a very similar test to the ELISA. The main difference is that the HIV proteins are separated so that you can see the individual reactions against the various HIV proteins separately. Except, again, we don't really know that they're HIV proteins. We're just guessing at it. And there's a big problem with the Western blot, because if you have HIV in your body, you should generate antibodies against everything. So if you're infected, you should light up all the proteins on the Western blot. And if you're uninfected, you should light up none of them. And what they find is that many people light up a few of them, and then they have at least 10 different algorithms where in some countries they'll say one of these proteins plus one of these plus two of these is a positive, and in others it will just be two proteins and it's a different group. And so they just have these arbitrary algorithms for determining if somebody is Western blot reactive or not. And so again, even if you do have a Western blot, it's not the same in every country. The test might be the same, but the interpretation is different.
What this means in lay language is that a great many people who had illnesses but not HIV infection were diagnosed and then told they had AIDS. Then they were put on the drugs. And as you mentioned earlier, Joan, we have seen thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people die once they were on these drugs. I remember in 1993, this fella came to the Tri-State Healing Center in New York City, and there we were working with about 1,200 people with AIDS-defining illnesses. And we were putting him on very holistic complementary protocols, healthy foods, organic juices, and antiviral homeopathic and other therapies. In any case, they were getting better, and there was a large support system for the non-medical approach, but they also knew that there was a nearly rabid disdain for anyone using a holistic therapy at that time, because there was one group who said, put time on your side, take the drug, and the drug at that time was AZT, later DDI, DDC, protease inhibitors, and this man came in one day, and he said, I heard that you're working with a lot of people with AIDS. I said, that's correct. He said, what is your protocol? And I told the protocol. I said, wow. He said, I just came from the West Coast. I've been in Los Angeles for about 7 years. Every single person in every single one of my AIDS support groups has died. I said, how many people is that? He said, all told, over 2,000. And I said, why'd they die? He said, because they're all on multiple drugs, and they're getting worse. And yet you have the people inside the AIDS community who come and keep promoting it. And the moment I would raise my hand saying, what about juicing, or what about detoxing, or what about natural immune therapies, they would shout you down. And he said, then one day I realized there was no one left, and I didn't want to go to another group and just watch everyone die, because there was no open and honest communication. Now, that is one man's experience. But Joan, from your experience doing your films and documentaries and research, how common is that phenomena where the AIDS community, a small segment, has coalesced around and become a part of the pharmaceutical interest, and hence are nothing more than propagandists for the pro-pharma approach to AIDS, and benefit from it? Your thoughts?
Well, Anne Sono is going to be on this program later, but a few months ago, I have a perfect example of this. She was going to screen her film at the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London, and the group running the Students' Union were supporting an AIDS charity called Stop AIDS. Now, they became very, very anxious about the fact we were going to show this film. And I, honestly, I haven't done the research, but I believe many of these charities are supported by the pharmaceutical industry. It turns out that the film was banned. We weren't allowed to screen it, and we protested vigorously. But the deputy principal of SOAS said he could do nothing because the students' union said they didn't want to show it. Those are the kinds of pressures that we're against.
I
haven't got the money to be able, and I wish I did, to research into exactly what the amounts of money are that go to these groups. But I remember ACT UP in England getting money for people to go to some of the, like the Berlin World AIDS Conference. They were funded to travel there by a drug company and to create a fuss and to say there weren't enough AIDS drugs around. There's no money to research into who is getting funded. I can't speak any more about people. I mean, recently in America, who've been David? Can you explain a bit more about one of our strongest critics called Mr. Kalichman?
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in the second hour. But he actually went undercover with using the name Joseph Newton. He's a psychology professor at the University of Connecticut, and I myself and many other AIDS dissenters got emails from a Joseph Newton who claimed to be a public health student, and he had these rather naive questions, and sometimes he sort of seemed to be trying to push you into doing something, like he'd kind of say something that made you feel a little bit, or was trying to make you feel a bit humiliated, like maybe he wanted us to go and blow up the NIH or something. I don't know, it seemed like he was trying to provoke something. So for a year or so, he went undercover with a false name, trying to get us, I guess, to say crazy things, which we didn't, until we figured out through various means that he was actually Seth Kalichman, a professor of psychology. But he's been funded to the tune of $38 million by the National Institute of Health since 1994. And really, he's funded in part to be a spy on the dissident movement. He's supposed to understand why people believe crazy things, like they have questions about HIV and AIDS, that's considered to be in denial, and that's a psychiatric condition, and you have to pay psychologists millions of dollars to study these people, and then presumably to work up methods whereby the government can combat the information that these people are, like ourselves, are trying to get out, and all we're trying to do is to ask legitimate questions.
Let us now hear from the Nobel Prize winner, Professor Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for discovery of the polymerase chain reaction technique used in AIDS. And I want you to hear what he has to say on this specific issue, because people won't debate him. You're not going to win a debate with this man. He's just too smart, and he's up on his data. Why has the American media avoided speaking with him on this issue? Here's Professor Kerry Mullis.
California microbiologist Dr. Kerry Mullis was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1993 for his development of one of the most widely used current techniques in molecular biology today, the PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. This revolutionary technique allows scientists to take a sample containing a very minute amount of DNA and replicate that DNA sequence until there are many copies. One of the first applications of PCR was to analyze human tissue for the presence of HIV. PCR is commonly used in medical and biological research labs for the detection of virus culture in infectious persons.
The people that are AIDS researchers now are getting neurotic. If you ask them any questions. There was a time when I first started asking questions, that all I wanted was, where are the papers? Just tell me the papers that you read that convinced you that HIV was the cause of AIDS, because I need to reference those papers in some of the, I was working on a test for HIV with PCR, and I needed to write a little report to the NIH to say, here's the progress we've made. And the first line of it was, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And I thought that was true. This is before I got involved. And I said, what's the reference for that quote? And I looked for it for about 2 or 3 years, and I never could find it. And by the end of 2 years, I'd ask everybody at every meeting that I'd gone to that talked about AIDS, I'd ask, you know, I'd look through every computer database. There is no reference. There is nobody who should get credit for that statement. Now, that's a pretty weird situation in science, where getting credit for a discovery is the most important thing in your life as a scientist.
It's silly to hear people saying, you don't believe that HIV causes AIDS? You don't believe that? I mean, it's just a word, but it's a very, very important distinction, I think, that you know, that's why, it's become a very emotional kind of thing, because people actually, they get personally committed to what really is a body of evidence that can be analyzed, you know, by lots of people, and at this point, there's so much of it out there, nobody can really analyze it, all of it, but nobody can write a review of it that says HIV causes AIDS because of this. You know, if a postdoc were to write a review of their literature that showed without much doubt that HIV was the cause of AIDS, that guy would be famous. Now there's 100,000 guys out there who had the opportunity. Just 10 years has passed. We've been waiting for this star postdoctoral fella to distinguish himself forever and get a lifelong grant from Tony Fauci, but he hasn't shown up. No one has bothered to write a definitive review. Any journal would take it. That right there proves that HIV does not cause AIDS. Just because Bob Gallo gets up, takes his sunglasses off and says, gentlemen, you discovered the cause of AIDS. That's all we have. New York Times article, CDC report, that's all we have. That's not enough. That's not enough to you know, that is not sufficient to like publish even a meager little scientific paper somewhere. That isn't enough for scientists to believe some inconsequential fact about some star 50 light years away. You know, that's certainly not enough to treat at the cost of billions of dollars a year and at the cost of a lot of lives and anguish and just destroyed, you know, lives have just been totally ruined by this thing on the basis of some flimsy little statement made by a guy who's known to be a crook in lots of other ways. He lied about a whole lot of other stuff. Why are we trust him there? If he was a witness in a courtroom, we wouldn't trust his testimony. We've caught him in too many lies. So you don't trust him anymore. Scientists are supposed to have some evidence that leads them tentatively to some conclusion or to some action. They're supposed to be able to show that to other scientists, any interested person, in fact, who's willing to understand what it is that was used as evidence, should be able to say, yeah, I agree with that. That makes sense, using rules of inference that we've used since Aristotle. What they look for is surrogate markers. Now, have you heard that term battered about? Surrogate markers means, well, it doesn't seem to do anything for the disease, but it does every now and then do something for the level of CD4 cells that we measure, or it does something for this or that. Not that anybody really knows whether you want more or less CD4 cells at any particular time in your life. A lot of diseases cause CD4 to go up. A lot of diseases cause it to go down. Nobody's even sure if a CD4 cell is always a CD4 cell. Just it's a marker on the cell at the time that they do this little counting procedure, which is to stick a fluorescent tag on there and say the ones that light up have CD4 on the outside. And we don't really know what those cells do. The immune system is incredibly complicated. And the immunologist's brains are not nearly complicated enough to deal with it. We have these little, you know, there are theories all over the place, but no real competent immunologist would tell you that CD4 levels was a surrogate marker for anything until we know more about it. But that's what they're using. That's what the FDA is saying. Yeah, you don't have to show that it helps them. These protease inhibitors, the same thing. You don't have to show that it helps the patient. You don't have to show a single life saved. All you have to do is show some little clinical indicator has changed in a way that somebody is hoping is going to make you better. The chances of you getting a human virus today are a hell of a lot higher than they were, say, 10,000 years ago. And it goes up in a funny way. Let's just say that there are an infinite number of retroviruses in the world because they're changing so fast you couldn't really count them. And as more and more people are in your life, you get more and more chances of getting retroviruses. Now, they all might be harmless. The chances are good that they are, because they're just barely alive. But if you hang out with 1,000 people a year in a way that would maybe allow you to get some or most of their retroviruses, and they hang out with 1,000 people a year, and they hang out with 1,000 people a year, you're hanging out with a fourth of the human race. You're getting all the retroviruses from all over the planet. Now, it might be that none of those things by themselves is going to hurt you, but we know that some of them do grow in your immune cells. Right? And they come in at very low multiplicity. You don't make an immune response every time you get a retrovirus inside of you somewhere. But if you have a cell in your immune system that has a retrovirus in it, and you promote that to clonality because it's going to be a part of an immune response, that cell, then the retrovirus will definitely escape. It will flower, in a sense, and it will then have to be dealt with by the immune system because there'll be enough of it showing in the blood that the immune system will go for it. Well, now, if you've got enough harmless but different retroviruses in your immune cells, such that every time you mount a new immune response, which means you probably take about 500 different immune cells and make 1,000,000 copies out of each one of them, if you've got enough retroviruses in your immune system such that one of those 500 is going to have a retrovirus in it that you've never made an immune response to before, you're going to have to make an immune response to it this time, because it will. If you make 1,000,000 copies of the cell, it's sure, the retrovirus is certain to flower, to like make infectious bodies, right? Then you have to make another immune response, right? It's called a chain reaction. Here we have a bunch of people that are definitely sick from some reason. It's likely that their behavior was so radically different than behavior that had gone. It was an experimental kind of behavior in a way. It's not unlikely that they would have some kind of problem, some health problems. People stop sleeping and eating. People start using all kinds of substances instead of food, and they're associating with the world's getting more and more densely populated, and we're spreading more and more diseases around. It's not totally shocking that those people should come down with some diseases that'll kill them. So we don't need to postulate that there was an infection going on, since nobody actually did show that there was. Here comes Gallo and Mountainier and the NIH saying, that's right, it's something else. It's something you didn't have. You're not responsible for it. You're just the beginning of it. We're all going to get it. And they liked that so much, because they said, we can go right ahead and do what we're doing. We just have to do a few little things differently, and then we'll be okay. They cling to that, you know, and they think if you suggest that it's their activity, that the way they live their life, that you're a homophobe or something, you're some kind of an idiot, there's something wrong with you. There's some of them that aren't that stupid, but, you know, there's a lot of them that are religiously associated with the notion. They believe in the notion that it is an infectious thing that will eventually sweep across the planet and kill everybody. PCR came along right about the same time that HIV did, and it was at CETUS that people started looking with PCR for HIV. That was the only way to see it, except for culture, which was a long, protracted procedure, which a lot of times didn't turn up the right. The results there weren't very good either.
Can be contaminated.
Oh, the cultures, the whole method, that cell biology is a bunch of magic half the time. And those culture, you know, the people that say they can do quantitative estimations of HIV from cultures are just, they're fooling themselves. The number of cases reported went up epidemically, you know, exponentially, because the number of tests that was done went up exponentially. How many doctors knew about HIV in 1983? Two. How many knew about it in 1985? Say 500. How many knew about it in 1986? 40,000. So that's where the curve came from. How much money did we make off of HIV this year? And they could have plotted that, and it would have looked the same. You know, and they could have said it's an epidemic because we're making more and more money off of it every year. If it's just caused by needles or it's just caused by homosexual activities, you're not going to really get a long, sustained public outcry against it, and nobody's going to want to spend $6 billion a year. They're going to say, well, we really didn't like those people anyhow. Great. I can't think of a better solution to the homosexual problem than a disease that'll kill them all. I mean, there would be congressmen that would talk about that quietly, not on television. So the CDC had to say, we can't say that. We've got to say it's got to be heterosexually transmitted. There's no proof that it's transmitted at all at that point. So why not just say, well, it's heterosexually transmitted too? Because that made it a plague, and the CDC needed one. The CDC hadn't had a good plague since polio. Their funding was probably going to be cut back if they didn't come up with one. The guy that was the head of the CDC, in fact, wrote memos that have been obtained, you know, that where he describes this as hot stuff. You know, those guys have got an agenda, which is not what we would like them to have, being that we pay for them to take care of our health in some way.
The scientists are, like you say, they are considered the final arbiters of what's good for the planet or what's bad for the planet. And they hadn't got the slightest idea. Instead of wearing white robes, they wear white lab coats, you know. Instead of, like, bringing you the word of God, they bring you the word of the EPA or whatever. And they don't have to understand what it is that they are making you do, in fact. And people, you know, just, I think they fall naturally into it because there is a need in humanity for something like a religion, something that makes you feel a part of some larger kind of group, something that you think, in spite of your wormy little life, makes you a part of something good, something big. When beliefs get tangled up with facts, matters of fact become matters of religious kind of significance, where if somebody gets mad at you for asking him a question in a scientific meeting, or says, we're never going to have Kerry Mullis at the European Union of whatever kind of scientists, or they put it in Nature, because he came in there and had the audacity to tell people that it might not be that bad to have sex, that AIDS might not be something you get from sex, that I don't see any evidence for it, is all I said. I don't see any evidence for it. What? You can't tell young people that.
Today, there are many scientists and physicians working within the conventional institutions who have similar viewpoints to those of the dissidents. Well, why don't they come out? Why don't they speak their minds? Is it possible that they take a look at what has happened when you do question the HIV equals AIDS equals death hypothesis? They've been suppressed. Dr. Peter Duisberg, noted scientist, was the main person in the line of fire.
Peter is a very scholarly person in addition to being brilliant, too. He's very careful. He doesn't say anything that he can't support. And also the most brilliant virologist.
Peter Duisberg at the University of California, Berkeley campus, is seen as someone who is now dangerous. His funding has been cut off. Graduate students are encouraged not to take his courses. And I think his administrative duties have included being in charge of the department picnic.
My funding, for example, from the National Institute of Health will not be renewed as of this year, and I may be out of business then. Also, my colleagues have essentially excommunicated me. I'm not invited to meetings, or hardly ever to meetings anymore, not ever to one on AIDS. I'm not allowed to publish in the same journals anymore as I used to. Even as a member of the National Academy, I cannot publish in the National Academy my views that drugs may be the cause of AIDS. And I have plenty of evidence to support it, to document my claim, which might be very relevant to the health of millions of Americans and people on this planet. Yet I'm censored because I'm essentially considered to be an outcast or an odd man or somebody who has controversial views.
He was a really well thought of guy too, because of his ideas, the whole field. I mean, in cancer, he's the guy that led him into the whole oncogene thing, you know? Big research bonanza. Anybody who could order a little kit from some company and hire a couple of technicians could be a cancer researcher because of things that Peter opened up. And then Peter said, no, I don't think that's actually the cause of cancer. And that made those guys a little bit angry.
You're going to be hearing live from Dr. Peter Duisberg in the next hour. You just listened to Professor Kerry Mullis, winner of the Nobel Prize, who had the courage to say, what if what you're doing is not right? And they went after him. Of course, they went after everyone. Final thoughts in this hour on what we've been discussing. We'll start with you, Joan Shinton.
Yes, that was very, very interesting to hear Kerry Mullis. I was reminded of something you said earlier about how when people were diagnosed, they were given the AIDS drugs, but their initial condition, the disease they had, wasn't treated. In Africa, I can remember in
in Uganda going to a hospital and going to the TB unit. And the head of the TB unit, a brilliant doctor called Dr. Okoton Wang, he was devastated because his patients, that they, when they started testing, they swooped into his wards, and they, these were American universities, actually, they tested the patient's blood. If they tested positive, which is highly likely because TB is one of the 70 that you mentioned earlier that can make you test positive, they were taken out of his TB wards. They were put into AIDS wards, and they were given these highly toxic antivirals, AZT, and they were given none of the drugs to try to control TB. So they usually died. And this is something, you know, you just reminded me of that terrible scenario.
Thank you. Let's also, David, your thoughts, please.
Well, I think that what Kerry Mullis says, he's there's a lot of points in what he says, but I think one of the most important things he addressed was the fact that the drugs were not tested against improving your health, and Bobby Russell can certainly testify to the side effects they cause. They're tested against improving your CD4 counts or more recently, your viral load, and those things have never been connected to HIV for the same reason that HIV tests have never been validated. And with both of those tests, there's a lot of evidence that there are many things that can modulate the, can make the CD4 and viral results go up and down that are not HIV.
I want to thank all of you for appearing. Dave is going to stay over for the next hour. Joan Shenton, thank you. Also, Bobby Russell, thank you, and we wish you well in your follow-up. And BobbyWRussell.com. We'll keep in the loop on that as well. And thank you all for listening to this hour. One more hour to go.
Thank you.
On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Mercy, mercy, me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Mercy, can't you stand?
This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our program today will focus upon HIV and AIDS, the science, and the censorship. Joining me is David Crowe, who will be giving his insights as we go. David is the spokesperson for the largest group of AIDS dissenting scientists, journalists, physicians in the world, nearing 3,000 individuals, multiple Nobel Prize winners, professor emerituses, professors of virology, award-winning journalists. Cumulatively, these people have published over 100,000 articles in the peer-reviewed literature. They looked for the truth. They found it after years of accepting the propaganda about what AIDS is and isn't, how it should be treated, how it should be tested for, and they were outraged. So much so that they put their reputations on the line by coming forward and saying, we need to reevaluate everything on AIDS. Now, this is not AIDS denialism, as those individuals with ACT UP and other groups would like you to believe. To the contrary, all of these people recognize that AIDS-defining illnesses are real and need to be treated properly. The difference is the bad science. Now, recently we had an expose in our society, rare as it may be, where Brian Williams, the most popular, highest paid, and news journalist as far as NBC and his nightly news, he acknowledged, under pressure, that he had lied. Not just once about his war story being in a helicopter that was hit and brought down, but also about seeing bodies float through the French Quarter in New Orleans. And now we'll see what other things come forward. How many journalists in the United States or public health officials at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the National Cancer Institute, how many editors-in-chiefs of major journals of medicine today would be in his shoes? Why? Because they published lies. They would have had to have known that many of the things we're publishing were wrong, inaccurate, and did not deserve the attention they got. But they went along with it. That's why this hour is so important, because the people you're going to hear from are all individuals who put their reputations on the line. We're going to be hearing from Professor Henry Bauer. Professor Bauer was Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies and a former dean at Virginia Polytech Institute and was the dean of the university's College of Arts and Sciences. After his retirement, he served as an editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration for 7 years. He received his doctorate at the University of Sydney in Australia and postdoctoral work at the University of Michigan. He's written several books, including Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, How Dominant Theories Monopolize Research and Stifle the Search for Truth. Earlier, he wrote The Origin, Persistence and Failings of HIV-AIDS Theory, which is among the first books to gather 20 years of research on HIV and AIDS, and to identify the scientific contradictions. And again, these contradictions were known to virtually everyone within the AIDS community. He had the courage to put them together. He will be joined by Terry Michael. Terry is a seasoned political reporter, a press secretary, who is currently the executive director for the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism, which sponsors the Politics and Journalism a semester to educate future political reporters. He also was the press secretary for the Democratic National Committee and later the press aide for Congressman Paul Simon. Terry has several journalism awards, including Distinguished Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists and the Presidential Award of the Association of Education in Journalism. Although being a journalist and a gay man living in Washington, D.C., one of the most critical cities on the HIV-AIDS agenda, he became active in the controversy about 8 years ago, and we'll talk with him about that. And also we'll be trying to get Dr. Peter Duesberg, Professor of Molecular and Cell Biology, University of California, Berkeley. He was the first to isolate a cancer gene through his work with retroviruses back in 1970 and mapped the genetic structure of this class of viruses. His work in retrovirus research awarded him an election to the National Academy of Sciences and outstanding investigator grants from the National Institutes of Health. He said that based upon his research, not opinion, not theory, that the single HIV virus could not be causing all of these 30 different conditions we call AIDS. And he published his results. As a consequence, he won support from scientists, but he also became an outcast. And we'll follow what happened to him in that journey. David Crowe from Canada, award-winning journalist, a person who spent a long time now studying the AIDS stories, meeting with journalists, scientists, physicians, activists, is here representing the 3,000 individuals who are part of the Reappraising of AIDS group. Nice to have you all with us today.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Gary.
We're going to begin first. We're going to begin with you, David.
Yeah. I'll talk about the Pat Goodson article, if that's a good way
yes,
to get started.
Yes, but put it in context that most of the people listening don't even know there is a controversy or has been a controversy about AIDS, because the American media has accepted one truth only, the truth that HIV will kill you, that you have to be tested with the antibody test, that when you test positive, you must go on the antiretroviral drugs to extend your life. That is the end of the story for them. We need you to go through why that's not true. So begin your input, please.
Yes. So there was an article published in September, I think, of last year in a journal called Frontiers in Public Health, which kind of implies from the title that it's dealing with somewhat more controversial issues. It was published by a professor at A&M University in College Station, Texas, entitled Questioning the HIV-AIDS Hypothesis, 30 Years of Dissent. And really, it was a very good summary of some of the people who believed that HIV was not the cause of AIDS and some of the evidence that they used to obtain their beliefs, to reach those beliefs. So predictably, once it was published, it was put on the website, there was outraged letters to the editors of the journal, and almost immediately the journal started a so-called investigation to see whether this should stay published. And in the past, like Professor Duisberg has had an article, I think it was in 2009, an article in Medical Hypothesis was withdrawn. They almost destroyed the journal. They were so anxious to get rid of it. But in this case, the investigation went on, and there was no reports on it until about a week or two ago, when there was really no report from the journal, but they downgraded the article to the status of an opinion article, and they allowed a man named Seth Kellickman to publish a commentary, which was really an ad hominem attack on Peter Duisberg and Henry Bauer and several other people who've criticized the HIV-AIDS theory. He didn't address the ideas of these people. But he points out that Peter Duisberg was the first to isolate an oncogene or a cancer gene, and then later said that he didn't think that genes caused cancers. So the fact that he changed his mind on an important scientific issue apparently made him ineligible to comment on any issue. Henry Bauer, who's with us today and can comment on this, has studied a number of controversial issues, including the existence of the Loch Ness Monster. And again, his bravery in studying an issue that many people have closed minds on led Seth Kellickman to say he should not be listened to at all. It's really an awful article, very unscientific, and as I said, it's just an ad hominem attack. It's an attack on the personalities of the people who have questioned the HIV-AIDS hypothesis, also including Carrie Mullis, who we heard from.
Okay, now, here is an important issue. Based upon working with more than 1,000 individuals with AIDS-defining illnesses for a number of years and seeing remarkable improvements in some cases, in 9 cases that we're working with us 6 days a week, 4 hours a day, 24 hours a week is a lot of time for 16 months. They all reversed all AIDS-defining illnesses. They were invited on Tony Brown's Journal on PBS. They had to be medically vetted. Their records had to be reviewed to make sure that these people had done this, and they did. And I then invited, over a one-year period, anyone who had medical confirmation that they could help their AIDS-defining illnesses using natural techniques. And we came forward with over 100 individuals. We held a press conference where their physicians, their medical records, an independent board of academic scientists had reviewed these, and each person had a chance to get up and give their story. We sent out press releases to 7,000 members of the media, every AIDS organization, every gay AIDS organization or organizations within the gay community that supported actively helping persons from their community who had AIDS-defining illnesses. Not one single member of any organization showed up. No member of the media showed up. Now, mind you, they were given 3 press releases and merely asked to come and review. They could criticize, they could be skeptical, but at least you're going to meet 100 people who are living healthy lives but not using AZT or the toxic drugs. The fact that no one came was revealing. Then, several years later, I had the world's leading scientists who questioned AIDS as at least how it was being viewed and treated come to New York. We had 1,600 people at a church on Central Park West. We filmed it, and each person got up and spoke. Not a single member of the mainstream media was there, or the AIDS communities. So that let me know that there was a story they didn't want. The journalists didn't want to hear it. The scientists and physicians didn't want to know it. The activists didn't want to know it. And yet there were a lot of activists who did. And so that let me very clearly know that this was a story that wasn't going to get any traction, that there's another approach to AIDS. Then Janine Roberts, a multi-award-winning journalist of 44 years, one of the most outstanding women journalists in the world. She's the one who gave us the information on blood diamonds. She was the one who told us about blood gold in the Congo. She was the one who told us about the genocide in the Congo of over 5.5 million killed, mainly because of the minerals, including that which was used in cell phones. She also gave us the information on the Aboriginal families having their children taken away and put into foster care in Australia based upon their kind of racist apartheid position. And she did all this. She wrote a scathing article on Robert Gallo, and she had information that I had not heard of before. And I want you to take it from there, David, to show what happened when information came forward that every journalist in America should have been on 60 Minutes, 2020, Dateline. They all should have picked this story up and ran with it, because just like they're all on Brian Williams today, they could have been on Robert Gallo had they chosen. You got a group of scientists, some of the most the esteemed scientists in the world, to sign a letter to the magazine Science, right, to reverse their position on writing, publishing the first articles about AIDS from Robert Gallo in his lab at the National Cancer Institute. Tell us that story and tell us what Janine Roberts discovered that is so revealing about the whole case on AIDS.
Well, there were a number of things that were actually first published by the Chicago Tribune. John Crutzen published them, but John Crutzen managed to somehow believe in the HIV-AIDS theory, even while proving quite conclusively that Robert Gallo was producing fraudulent science. A couple of things that stick out is that he got a letter just before he published some of his first HIV articles, is saying that no retroviruses were found in the sample that was sent for electron microscope work. The second thing was that his lab assistant, Mikolas Popovic, had basically written this seminal article on HIV, and Gallo was away at a conference or something. And when he came back, he just completely rewrote the article, and basically the marginal comments, like the actual handwritten comments, were made available because Mikolas Popovic knew that what was happening was unethical, so he sent a copy to, I think, his sister in Czechoslovakia or something like that. And in the margins, Robert Gallo was basically saying, look, this is not sounding like a seminal paper. We cannot say, you know, this is interesting. We have to say we found the cause of AIDS. And so basically Gallo sexed up the article to the point where it could go into Science, which is, of course, the voice of the American scientific establishment, which occurred a little bit after the press conference by the head of HHS. I forget her name. So basically, they got patents on the blood test. They had a press conference, and then they published some science, which turned out later to be rotten science. And you know, nobody really wanted to know about this. And Janine Roberts' investigations and book are a very good summary of the corrupt science of HIV and AIDS, and also some other diseases like polio.
Okay, thank you. Let's go over now and say hello again. Nice to have you with us, Professor Bauer.
Would you? Henry, are you with us?
Yes. Professor Bauer, can you hear us? He might be away from there for a moment. Let's go over and say hello to Terry Michael. Nice to have you with us today, Terry.
Thanks, Gary. It was nice to be with you again. It's been a while.
Let's go through several areas, please, in depth. First, you saw what happened to those gay journalists, including Charles Ortlieb and others at the New York Native around the country, who began to question the single virus theory, believed that it could have been other viruses or other conditions. No one denied AIDS, but they were challenging the AZT. John Lauritsen was publishing in their journals, and the whole industrial, medical, pharmaceutical community began to go after any journalist, especially a gay journalist, who had more credibility, and attack them and destroy their reputations. Talk about when you first discovered that there were contradictions between the official story of AIDS and what later became the story of AIDS, and what it did to you and how they went after you.
Well, interestingly, I didn't actually see those things back in the 1980s or 1990s, because even though I was sitting here in Washington, the ground zero of the invention of the AIDS virus, that is, the invention of the hypothesis that a single pathogen could cause all these diseases, I was press secretary of the Democratic National Committee on April 23, 1984, the very day that Margaret Heckler, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, announced to the world that the probable cause of AIDS had been found in the middle of Ronald Reagan, the other party's presidential campaign. I, as a gay man in his early 30s at that point, didn't really question it, because I saw absolutely nothing in the mainstream media or in the gay media. Our gay paper here in Washington, The Blade, is 40 years old. It considers itself the paper of record in the gay community. None of these outlets would publish a word about the dissent that came along in 1987, and that continued into the 90s and into the 21st century. I only learned about the dissent reading a website, a libertarian website, and it was actually 8 years ago this coming Sunday, February 22, 2007. And that link to Christian Majority, one of the leading, the late Christian Majority, one of the leading dissidents in the country, about dissent. And I started reading every single thing I could get. In fact, I sort of, not to compare myself to him, was like Thabo Mbeki. I went to the internet and did my own research. I always tell people there's only one authority, and that is you, and you have to do the reading in order to educate yourself. So I only began about 8 years ago. I'm sort of a latecomer to this, and I have come to the conclusion several years ago that there is not now, there never was, a human immunodeficiency virus. There was immunodeficiency, which I prefer to call it instead of AIDS. AIDS is not a disease, it's a definition. And so I've been working on it ever since, and I'm working on a book right now. I would note this about journalists, something you said about how many journalists out there are like Brian Williams, very different people, who lie about medical science factors. I'm not sure it's overt lies. I think it is medical science illiteracy. Most journalists who I know, and I have a journalism degree from 40 years ago from the University of Illinois, wouldn't know the inside of a biology lab from a Labrador retriever. That's because we hated science. We would never not question a president about to start an elective war. We would never fail to question a Wall Street banker creating a mortgage meltdown. Hell, we would not even question the National Football League trying to extort local taxpayer money to build a stadium. But because we know nothing about science, we will not challenge those guys in white lab coats. And then they get away with murder, as we'll talk on here, almost literally get away with murder. And that's what is lacking. We have no mainstream media that even has the intelligence to ask a rational question about this hypothesis, and that was more true than ever on April 23, 1984, when by the very next day, the probable cause of AIDS became the cause of AIDS.
And Terry, you've tried to talk to, you have pretty good connections with some mainstream journalists at like the Washington Post and places like that, and you've tried to talk to them about this issue, and how's that gone?
Oh, I tried in many ways. I have tried the health reporter of the Washington Post. He's no longer the health reporter. When I wanted to get into, as a dissident, the 19th International AIDS Society, that is a Geneva-based lobbying organization for AIDS researchers, and I had to talk my way in. That Post reporter did help me get credentials. He told them, he said, if you don't, he's one of the leading AIDS dissidents in Washington. If you don't let him in, it'll probably cause trouble. So I had to promise not to cause trouble, and I went into it. And there was a media panel, very first day of the conference. And this was filled with the likely suspects, including Tony Fauci. And I asked this Washington Post reporter, I said, you know, Luc Montagnier recently said that the body can clear itself of HIV in a few weeks if you have a good immune system. Why haven't you reported that? And he said, well, he's not relevant. And I said, not relevant? He just won the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV. And he said, oh, well, he's been completely discredited. That's what we're up against. We're up against a mainstream media that knows nothing about science, that simply accepts the word of these guys in long-sleeve white lab coats, who, frankly, if you know anything about this, about science studies, which Henry Bauer is an expert on, I hope we get him back online, this, people who are in white lab coats can be just as prevaricating, just as ambitious to win prizes, just as ambitious to enrich themselves as those politicians on Capitol Hill who fund their budgets.
One more question for you at this time, please. Terry, when I was interviewing a whole group of AIDS scientists and dissidents, they said, follow the money trail. They gave me examples of AIDS organizations that specifically brought certain gays in who they knew would be favorable to the press. And they said, look at the amount of money that they receive. Then look at what they promote. Then look at what they'll do to attack anyone, including other gays. Are you familiar with any organizations and individuals within those organizations that tout the big pharma line simply because?
Obviously, I don't know them all personally, but there are thousands of them. They are among the half dozen stakeholders in perpetuating the myth. There are about 10,000 HIV, AIDS, nonprofits, they call them NGOs in the rest of the world. Let me give you a hard example of how corrupt they are. In 2009, the Washington Post did a survey of the 95 HIV, AIDS organizations in the Washington, D.C. area. They looked at their budgets from 2004 to 2008. They had received about $80 million passed through to them by the local D.C., Washington, D.C., HIV-AIDS agency. The Washington Post could not find documentation for $25 million worth of that money. It's a scam. The HIV-AIDS so-called charities, like MFAR or like Elton John's outfit, they have a vested interest in keeping the myth alive because I can't get hard numbers on this, but I would guess that these thousands and thousands of HIV nonprofits have budgets that probably compiled total $1 billion, and they have thousands of employees. It's just like tens of thousands of AIDS researchers funded by Tony Fauci of NIH. It's just like all of the testing companies that have a stake in the HIV so-called test and the CD4 test and the viral load test. And then, of course, there are the big drug companies who are in collusion. The drug companies actually, by U.S. law, fund the Food and Drug Administration. So it's putting the fox in the hen house. So I could go on, but you have at least a half dozen stakeholders who, if this myth were exploded, would be out of business. It directly and the United States government itself has spent over $430 billion in the last 30 years on this myth.
Terry Michael, multi-award-winning gay reporter in New York and Washington, D.C. Please hold on. Now let's go back. We have Henry Bauer. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Bauer.
Yes, I don't know what went wrong with my microphone.
It's all right. You're back now. Dr.
Yeah.
Bauer, tell us about what you looked at since you were dean of the Virginia Polytech Institute. You were professor emeritus of chemistry and science studies. You were the you also were the university's dean of arts and sciences and the editor-in-chief of Journal of Scientific Exploration. I simply mention that because you are a scientist, publishing hundreds of peer-reviewed journals, so you know good science from faulty science and fraudulent science, and today we have a lot of corporate fraudulent science. It's not a secret. It's been published about and by Professor now Angel at Harvard, who was with the New England Journal of Medicine. Tell us what you saw within the science that was being reported and written about that caused you concern, and then what did you find that just simply did not hold up and was not accurate?
Well, the main thing that I found when I started looking seriously at HIV/AIDS was that if you look at the spread, the distribution of positive HIV tests, it becomes obvious that those tests are not picking up a sexually transmitted agent. I was led to do that by a statement in a book by Harvey Bialy, and I collated the results of essentially all the published HIV tests up to the late 1990s. But I want to put a slightly different slant on things. We tend to concentrate so much on what the substantive facts are. But the problem is to get people to even consider the possibility that something that has been so widely accepted by official institutions could possibly be wrong. So the context is science has enormous prestige. It's the intellectual authority. And that includes medicine and medical science. But the fact of the matter is that mainstream science has often been wrong in the past. But there has been no widely known precedent for it to be so drastically wrong for so long as it has been about HIV/AIDS. So one of the essential things is to recognize that science is fallible. The second thing is the popular view of science and how reliable it is stems from past history. And scientific activity changed dramatically in the middle of the 20th century. Before that, it had not been an activity that generated large numbers of celebrities and people who could become wealthy by doing science. Since the middle of the 20th century, that has changed drastically. And now, scientific research and medical research are so important parts of society and of federal budgets that it becomes very, very difficult for people to entertain the possibility that it could be wrong about something so drastic. In point of fact, there are a couple of less talked about issues where official science has actually been a failure for 50 years. One of them is the war on cancer, which is running for about half a century, and we no better understand what causes cancer now than we did before. Another one is the attempt by physicists to reproduce the conditions inside the sun in order to produce useful power under controlled conditions on Earth. That's been going for about 50 years. And at the beginning, it was projected that a prototype reactor would be ready in about 3 decades. And the present estimate is still about 3 decades into the future. So,
one more question.
Yeah.
At this time, when you look at how many papers, hundreds of thousands of papers published on AIDS, how can they be so confident that they don't even allow debate on the different parts of the AIDS equation? They don't allow Carrie Mullis, yourself, Peter Duesberg, to come forward and to challenge them, to try to deconstruct their paradigm. Well, isn't that unusual? Doesn't that send up a red flag?
No, because the history of science is quite clear that the most dramatic discoveries have always been resisted by the scientific community itself. It's only by hindsight that people have become stars and greatly lauded. There was a 1961 article in Science magazine by the sociologist Bernard Barber, who pointed out that all really important novelties have been resisted. The title of his article is Resistance by Scientists to Scientific Discovery. And, you know, this is just another illustration of the significance of the widespread ignorance about the nature of scientific activity and its history. But even though those discoveries were always resisted by the scientific community, what has changed in the last half century or so is that there are such enormous vested interests, commercial and governmental interests, that they're able to suppress dissent much more effectively than in the past.
Gary, can I add one 30-second observation there? Eisenhower, in his farewell address in 1961, famous for the military-industrial complex phrase, said something else extremely important. A government grant has become almost a substitute for intellectual curiosity. The medical scientists, the scientists at work before the federal government started handing out these huge grants, was kind of the lone tinkerer in a lab seeking truth on his university salary. After Sputnik, and we started spending tons of money on science and other research, what we saw was a grasping of what became scores, hundreds of billions of dollars in government grants. Research universities started taking off the top 20 or 30% whenever one of their scientists won a grant. So the race was on for money. You got to follow the money trail here. And this whole thing is fueled by the desire not to lose that money. That's why these tens of thousands of researchers that Anthony Fauci, for 30 years, the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, they don't want to give up that money. This money is handed out by so-called peer groups, but really they're old boys' networks, and if you don't agree with them, you don't get the dollars.
Yeah, the
Terry Michaels
actually
there.
In that same speech, Eisenhower put it this way, that one has to beware that public policy could become captured by a scientific technological elite.
Well, that's exactly where we're at today. Happened. We have, in effect, also a form of medical McCarthyism. And hold your thoughts, because I want to bring Dr. Peter Duesberg on, because more than anyone else I know of in the field of AIDS research, he dared to ask them to examine that there may be other causes, including lifestyle causes, to the question of AIDS, defining illnesses. Well, if you're saying it's a virus, and you want all this money to go into viruses, and you want to say that it's going to be infecting everyone, then lifestyle you don't want to hear about. Let's say hello to Dr. Peter Duesberg. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello. It's Peter Duesberg here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. We can hear you fine.
Hello, Peter.
Hello. Hello, Henry.
Hi,
are you there, too?
Yeah.
Peter, tell us the story of what you discovered early on, what you believe were the causes of AIDS, and how you wrote about it, and what happened because of that.
I have worked as a virologist, particularly a retrobiologist, a group of viruses to which HIV belongs, ever since I came to the U.S. from Germany in 1964 in the virus cancer program. That was actually one of the leaders was Wendell Stanley, the first Nobel Prize in virology. I was his postdoc for something like 5 or 6 years. So the prediction was if a virus is causing a disease, it would spread exponentially in the population. That is, one person gets infected, 10 further get infected, and so on. It reaches a peak. Then the epidemic stops because of immunity, and that has been the history of viral diseases and epidemics in millions of years. The flu in 1918, the great flu epidemic, it subsided once a resistant population grew up and antibodies against the virus were made. If that had never worked that way, or ever not worked that way, we wouldn't be talking to each other. We would have been wiped out by these microbes. And so it has been with all viral epidemics in the history of mankind or humankind or life. And now here comes HIV/AIDS. Well, it's said to be a new epidemic in 1983-84. It was expected it would spread exponentially in the population. Sexually transmitted, heterosexuals would get it, of course, because there's still more heterosexuals than homosexuals, or more heterosexual average normal couples or people than intravenous drug users. So the whole American population would be at high risk of being wiped out. That was exactly the prediction. So what happened? We are now 27, 28, 30 years later. We are still around. There is no heterosexual AIDS. But there were 5 million babies born per year by conventional heterosexual AIDS. They don't have AIDS. AIDS, as you already pointed out, Henry pointed out, I think Terry pointed out, is totally restricted to two main risk groups, a small fraction of the male homosexual population that use lots of recreational drugs and have dozens of often by their own records, thousands of sexual contacts, and intravenous drug use. Those are the only ones who get AIDS, and here's your answer. What else could be the common denominator for these risk groups? And namely, it is recreational drugs, lifestyle, as you want, as a euphemism, or what is even more common now is anti-HIV, antiviral drugs, which are all based on DNA chain terminators like chemotherapy inevitably killing cells, or proteins, inhibitors, which likewise are very toxic and inevitably causing disease and fatal disease. So AIDS is not like a conventional epidemic, a viral epidemic. It doesn't spread exponentially. It didn't end exponentially. And all we find is antibodies against the virus that's left from an harmless virus infection, and that is unable to do anything biochemically. It's dead as a doornail. You cannot find the virus in AIDS patients. The case of the scandal of Dr. Gallo, once the leading AIDS researcher in the country, is a case in point. I mean, he tried very hard to find it, but he could get it only from a colleague in France, which an investigation later showed was not from his lab, but from another lab. So we have we have rules in science all along, and we always compare new epidemics to presumably older ones and consistent ones, and the so-called AIDS epidemic does not fit any epidemiological precedent of a viral epidemic we have ever had. It doesn't spread generally or heterosexually or in a general population. It isn't stopped by antiviral immunity. In fact, the only thing we ever find is antiviral immunity, and it doesn't seem to be contagious at all. So that was a major objection. And then as a biochemist, if you look at so-called AIDS patients, even then when they're dying from it, you can't find no virus, only antibodies against it, which for 200 years have been the indication for resistance against the viral infection or the cure or the, if you want, prevention or so-called vaccines. That's antibodies against the virus. That's all we find there. How could that possibly cause a disease? So that was my reason for calling it into question. And none of these questions, not one, why is it not spreading sexually in the general population? Why is it not active? Why does antiviral immunity not prevent or stop it? And how come drugs that we prescribing people as so-called antiviral drugs, are causing exactly what actually AIDS is supposedly causing, or the recreational drugs are causing so-called AIDS disease?
When I was at the University of California at Berkeley,
yep.
And I had finished filming with you, I walked down the hall, and there were two senior, highly respected professors there at the time. And I asked them, could I talk with them? They said yes. So I just sat there and I said, Peter Duisberg has put his whole reputation on the line here. Do you think his reputation is strong enough that he can withstand the pushback from the vested interest? And they said, no. And I said, be
specific.
You never
told me that story.
Yes.
And, who were they?
Yes, really. And here's what Professor Stroman said. He said, Peter is without doubt the brightest guy here. He said this. He said, however, a university setting, especially for a tenured professor, is very comfortable until you make other people uncomfortable. You have to look at the funding. You have to look at the politics. You have to look at San Francisco being the number one gay community in the United States and the political action groups within the gay community who are going to start going against Peter, which means the university. They're going to exert every pressure they can. So the university is going to have to compromise, and the likelihood is he will be teaching to empty classrooms and not receiving any grants, but technically still part of the university. This is what he told me. So knowing how long ago you began to be attacked and what they've done over the years of calling you an AIDS denialist, and as they do many other people, by the way, in fact, anyone who questions the way that AIDS is approached, they attack. And yet, when you told me that you believe that the AIDS cases were staying in very specific groups, the hemophiliacs, the fast-track gays, I came back to New York, and I decided to challenge you. You didn't know this. So I invited a lot of gays in my audience. There was a gay vegetarian society, and there were hundreds. I'm going to guess around 600 people. The whole room, this big lecture room, was filled. And I said, how many people here have a lot of sex? All the hands went up. How many people here have had sexually transmitted diseases? Hands went up. I said, how many people have been tested for HIV? All the hands went up. How many have tested positive? Two hands. And then I asked those specific people, were you doing anything else? Were you doing amyl nitrate? Were you smoking and drinking, staying up all night? The answer was yes. Had you had recurring bouts of syphilis or gonorrhea? The answer was yes. I said, so is it fair then from this group to suggest that it's not being gay that causes AIDS, but rather the lifestyle within that, and isn't also true for straights, because I did the same thing with a group of swingers. The people had lots of sex, but it was only those swingers that were using amyl nitrates, so they could have multiple sexual experiences one night, and other drugs, they were coming down with conditions virtually identical to AIDS-defining illnesses, but never questioned about AIDS. And as a result, there was a corresponding group within the heterosexual community. I then spent 2.5 years almost every night with different people I knew within the gay community, introducing me to people down in on Christopher Street and at the various clubs. I wanted to see for myself. I didn't want to take anyone's word for it. And I saw the lifestyle. And I also saw people who were healthy, and then every night partying till 5 in the morning, getting home, getting dressed, going to work, partying again until they got sick, their immune collapsed. And I said to one of them one night, you realize that you take the strongest, fastest, healthiest Olympic athlete in the world. If that athlete followed your lifestyle, in a year, they'd be dead. And the person said, yeah. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Could you now share with us what has happened to you over the years and where you are today in educating the public about the truth as you know it about AIDS?
You asking me now?
Yes, Peter.
Oh, what I think you described it as best as you as I ever heard it. I mean, it's perfectly right. I mean, it is chemically the only consistent explanation. If you take drugs that make you work way beyond natural design, you eventually pay for it. Intravenous drug users have a life expectancy on average of 33 years compared to the rest of us who can count on 80 years or even more. Those drugs are moving things faster. You don't eat right, you don't drink right, you don't have a steady salary, you can't pay for a home anymore, and then you get tuberculosis, or you could get fever and you get pneumonia. And that's exactly what happened in the fast lane gay community, and it's still to some degree happening now. And then worst of all, you take what our medical institutions have come up with, NIH, NCI, antiviral drugs, which are nothing but DNA chain terminus drugs designed, not a side effect. I'm not saying a side effect or an accident or something we can't help. No, they were designed to kill human cells for chemotherapy 30, 40 years ago. Even now, they're used that way. This is essentially exactly the same drug, ACT or TDI or iodine, oxyuridine, or which one you call, any one of them. The same principle, they're designed to kill human cells. Now, you're supposed to take those indefinitely, every day in your life. So no wonder you're going to die from AIDS-defining diseases within a couple of years. You're aging faster, you get demented, you get pneumonia, you get lung disease, you get kidney disease, liver diseases. That's how AIDS patients die now. Although even liver and lung diseases and kidney diseases were not, or still are not, in the definition of the diseases that HIV is causing. These are diseases that are exactly the consequences of the antiviral drugs.
When you were attacked and your character was attacked, your reputation was attacked, put us in your mind of how you were trying to cope with this, since historically you had never had these types of attacks. You were lauded as the golden boy of retrobiology.
Yeah, I was the blue-eyed boy for quite a while. I got every grant I wanted. I got in the academy. I got promoted very rapidly from a postdoc to a full professor. I thought I was above it all. I was a true romantic, scientific, romantic genius, I thought. I was nothing could happen to me. And sure enough, it didn't quite pan out this way, exactly as you predicted, or these professors in the hallway told you. Sooner or later, they were wearing you down. The classrooms were empty. I have not received even one grant ever since I questioned HIV or AIDS. So this is now 20 years ago. In the first 20 years, there was not one single time when I ever didn't get a grant that I applied for. and I had the best guns available at the time, or the best that I wanted to have. I didn't want to have a lab of 100 people, but I had everything I wanted until then. And remember in the academy, now they would like to get rid of me, or I was had tenure at Berkeley, all of these great things. And now all of this is essentially sort of gone. It depends now on philanthropic contributions here and then, but they're very shaky. I mean, not totally shaky, but quite shaky. I cannot count on anything for more than a year at the most. And in experiments in cancer and in AIDS, you have to run programs that go over several years because the disease is slow. The so-called latency for this virus, a virus like HIV, is supposed to be 10 years. You get infected today from that's the dogma, the HIV-AIDS dogma of of the U.S., the national AIDS dogma, or Montagnier in France or in Europe. They all follow us, totally obsequious to AIDS, to American predominance in science. Yes, this virus needs 10 years from infection today to cause pneumonia or diarrhea or dementia 10 years later. Well, there's not one shred of an explanation for this, and it can't be. All viruses replicate within days at the minimum, so the consequences should be apparent fast or will never be apparent. So for any of these experiments, you need some time. You can't do them in a week or in a month like in the old days with bacteria and phages. It goes over years. And so those programs are virtually impossible now for me to run because I don't have any government grants that go over 3 to 5. I had one, the last one I had was 7 years, very unrestricted, outstanding investigator grant from the NIH. But since I question HIV, I'm become, as they call it now, a new scientific word, by the way, a denialist. That used to be in religion, I think. If you didn't believe in God, then you were a denialist. You were Satan or somebody like that, or the devil. But in science, that wasn't used before. If you don't subscribe to somebody else's hypothesis or theory, you have your own theory. And that was, in fact, the hallmark or the characteristic of a good scientist. Now, if you don't follow mainstream, you're called a denialist. Like you are a Protestant when you're supposed to be Catholic. Luther was a denialist here.
Well, Peter, I want everyone to have a chance to give a final thought.
Oh, sure.
Terry Michael, is your final thought, please?
I'm not sure if he's online. Maybe we should go to Henry first.
All right, Henry, your thoughts, please.
Yes.
A final thought.
I wanted to say that in a nutshell, the present situation can be gathered from an article Celia Farber wrote about the way Peter was treated. It's one of Peter's colleagues who said she didn't really care whether Peter was right or wrong. He should have agreed with the mainstream because a scientific career requires political savvy. Now, these are the sorts of people who are populating tenured positions in places like the University of California at Berkeley.
Okay. And actually, Henry, I was in Peter's lab waiting for him, and an old colleague walked in, a German scientist, and I said, "Are you interested in Peter's ideas on AIDS?" And he said, "Peter was wrong." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said he was wrong to go up against the establishment. Not his job to talk about science in public. He should just be in the lab doing science and not causing trouble.
Wow. Terry Michael, final comment, please.
Okay, well, I just missed the last 15 minutes of your conversation but because my phone went dead. But I will say as a last comment that what we're really up against here is the need for a paradigm shift. As Henry can explain much better than I, science doesn't improve in tiny little increments. As I believe it was Thomas Kuhn who wrote in Scientific Revolutions, there has to be paradigm shifts. And though I'm not advocating death, I would advocate retirement for the worst offender. And the worst offender is Anthony Fauci. For 30 years, the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the guy who's handed out scores of billions of dollars, who keeps this lie going. He's 72. Let's hope he retires soon, because until we get new blood in there, until we get rid of the old boys network, until we convince politicians that they've been funding a lie, we really can't make very much progress. Maybe that's because I'm sitting here in the center of this political mess, Washington, D.C., where the AIDS virus was invented.
Terry Michael, Professor Peter Duisberg, Professor Henry Bauer, and David Crowe, thank you all for being a part of our special today.
Oh, you don't want any last words from me?
Very quickly, yes.
Okay, one little thing. Did you introduce Patricia Gutzen's paper?
We did talk about it, Peter, yes, before you got on the line.
I think is very, very hopeful sign that despite all the suppression, despite the excommunication and denialisms and religious type of exclusions, here science cannot be manipulated or politicized forever. In the end, the facts will count. And this is showing, I think, that now a neutral person, none of us knew Pat Goodson until 4 months ago. All of a sudden, out of the blue, comes somebody from Texas A&M and summarizes many of the dissident arguments and logic and evidence in a paper that they want to censor now. That's how much how consistent and how scientifically strong the evidence is and has survived. And I think it's irreversible. They can't get it out of the literature and out of the laboratories and out of the minds anymore. In the end, I think we will win. It could be a couple of hundred years, like Galileo. You know, he was locked up with spaghetti and a little bit.
Peter, Galileo didn't have the internet. We will get another day and another forum in the near future. This battle is not over. Yeah. Thank you all very much. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.